This Knossos wasn't so much a town as the vast palace of the king and his people. It wasn't even fortified. The kings, it would seem, were called Minos, always, as the kings of Egypt were all called Pharaoh. The king of Knossos figures in the early legends of the Greeks as King Minos, who lived in the labyrinth and kept there a horrible monster, half man, half bull, the Minotaur, to feed which he levied a tribute of youths and maidens from the Athenians. Those stories are a part of Greek literature, and have always been known, but it's only in the last few decades that the excavations at Knossos have revealed how close these legends were to the reality. The Cretan labyrinth was a building as stately, complex, and luxurious as any in the ancient world. Among other details, we find water pipes, bathrooms, and the like conveniences, such as have hitherto been regarded as the latest refinements of modern life. The pottery, the textile manufactures, the sculpture and painting of these people, their gem and ivory work, their metal and inlaid work, is as admirable as any that mankind has produced. They were much given to festivals and shows, and in particular they were addicted to bullfights and gymnastic entertainments. Their female costume became astonishingly modern in style. Their women wore corsets and flounced dresses. They had a system of writing which hasn't yet been deciphered. It's the custom nowadays to make a sort of wonder of these achievements of the Cretans as though they were a people of incredible artistic ability living in the dawn of the civilization. But their great time was long past that dawn, as late as 2000 BC. It took them many centuries to reach their best in art and skill, and their art and luxury are by no means so great a wonder if we reflect that for 3,000 years they were immune from invasion, that for 1,000 years they were at peace. Century after century, their artisans could perfect their skill, and their men and women refine upon refinement. Wherever men of almost any race have been comparatively safe in this fashion for such a length of time, they've developed much artistic beauty. Given the opportunity, all races are artistic. Greek legend has it that it was in Crete that Daedalus attempted to make the first flying machine. Daedalus, which means cunning artificer, was a sort of personified summary of mechanical skill. It's curious to speculate what germ of fact lies behind him and those waxen wings that, according to the legend, melted and plunged his son Icarus in the sea. There came at last a change in the condition of the lives of these Cretans, for other peoples, the Greeks and the Phoenicians, were also coming out with powerful fleets upon the seas. We don't know what led to the disaster, nor who inflicted it, but somewhere about 1400 BC, Knossos was sacked and burnt, and though the Cretan life struggled on there rather lamely for another 4 centuries, there came at last a final blow about 1000 BC, that's to say, in the days of the Assyrian ascendancy in the east. The palace of Knossos was destroyed, and never rebuilt, nor re-inhabited. Possibly this was done by the ships of those newcomers into the Mediterranean, the barbaric Greeks, a group of Aryan-speaking tribes from the north who may have wiped out Knossos as they wiped out the city of Troy. The legend of Theseus tells of such a raid. He entered the labyrinth, which may have been the Knossos palace, by the aid of Ariadne, the daughter of Minos, and slew the Minotaur. The Iliad makes it clear that destruction came upon Troy because the Trojans stole Greek women. Modern writers with modern ideas in their heads have tried to make out that the Greeks assailed Troy in order to secure a trade route or some such fine-spun commercial advantage. If so, the authors of the Iliad hid the motives of their characters very skillfully. It would be about as reasonable to say that the Homeric Greeks went to war with the Trojans in order to be well ahead with a station on the Berlin to Baghdad railway. The Homeric Greeks were a healthy, barbaric, Aryan people with very poor ideas about trade and trade routes. They went to war with the Trojans because they were thoroughly annoyed about this stealing of women. It's fairly clear from the Minos legend and from the evidence of the Knossos remains that the Cretans kidnapped or stole youths and maidens to be slaves, bullfighters, athletes, and perhaps sacrifices. They traded fairly with the Egyptians, but it may be they didn't realize the gathering strength of the Greek barbarians. They traded violently with them, and so brought sword and flame upon themselves. Another great sea people were the Phoenicians. They were great seamen because they were great traders. Their colony of Carthage, founded before 800 BC by Tyre, became at last greater than any of the older Phoenician cities, but already before 1500 BC, both Sidon and Tyre had settlements upon the African coast. Carthage was comparatively inaccessible to the Assyrian and Babylonian hosts, and profiting greatly by the long siege of Tyre by Nebuchadnezzar II, became the greatest maritime power the world had hitherto seen. She claimed the western Mediterranean as her own, and seized every ship she could catch west of Sardinia. Roman writers accuse her of great cruelties. She fought the Greeks for Sicily, and later, in the 2nd century BC, she fought the Romans. Alexander the Great formed plans for her conquest, but he died, as we shall tell later, before he could carry them out. Third, at her zenith, Carthage probably had the hitherto unheard-of population of 1 million. This population was largely industrial, and her woven goods were universally famous. As well as a coasting trade, she had a considerable land trade with Central Africa, and she sold Negro slaves, ivory, metals, precious stones, and the like to all the Mediterranean people. She worked Spanish copper mines, and her ships went out into the Atlantic and coasted along Portugal and France northward as far as the Cassiterides, the Scilly Isles, or Cornwall in England, to get tin. About 520 BC, a certain Hanno made a voyage that's still one of the most notable in the world. This Hanno, if we may trust the Periplus of Hanno, the Greek translation of his account, which still survives, followed the African coast southward from the Straits of Gibraltar as far as the confines of Liberia. He had 60 big ships, and his main task was to found or reinforce certain Carthaginian stations upon the Morocco coast. Then he pushed southward. He founded a settlement in the Rio de Oro on Kearney or Herney Island, and sailed on past the Senegal River. Voyagers passed on for 7 days beyond the Gambia and landed at last upon some island. This they left in a panic, because although the day was silent with the silence of the tropical forests, at night they heard the sound of flutes, drums, and gongs, and the sky was red with the blaze of the bush fires. The coast country for the rest of the voyage was one blaze of fire from the burning of the bush. Streams of fire ran down the hills into the sea, and at length a blaze arose so loftily that it touched the skies. 3 days further brought them to an island containing a lake, Sherbro Island, perhaps. In this lake was another island, perhaps Macaulay Island, and on this were wild, hairy men and women, whom the interpreters called gorilla. The Carthaginians, having caught some of the females of these gorillas, they were probably chimpanzees, turned back and eventually deposited the skins of their captives, who had proved impossibly violent guests to entertain on board ship, in the temple of Juno. A still more wonderful Phoenician sea voyage, long doubted but now supported by some archaeological evidence, is related by Herodotus.